this is a pretty familiar situation now, so if you like, you can come here to the... Well, there are many empty chairs. We can make it more familiar, if you like. If you're interested in distance, okay, you can keep the distance. But, well, if you don't understand or if you don't see, just come a little bit closer. Okay, well, my name is Michael Funk. I guess some of you already know who I am because I did the presentation on October the 10th about the history, and especially focusing on the 19th century and later on, so Plessner, Wittgenstein, Heidegger, Kapp, and other authors. This is what I did in October, and today I'm going to give the last lecture of this whole lecture series, which is about technologies and wars. The good thing is now it is a little bit more open, a little bit more easygoing, so we can decide how deep we want to jump into the whole issue, the whole problematic field with all its very complex epistemological, terminological, and ethical issues and problems. Technologies and wars. Let us start with the first simple observation. Wars are boosters for technological developments. For example, World War II. Many examples could be mentioned. I'm just going to focus some of the Second World War. One example is the radar technology, for example. This is a German model. This picture is from 1942, I think. And here you see a map of England, the British Islands. And here you see how they have been secured by radar technologies during the Second World War. This was technologically a very important factor for the air battle, Luftschlacht England, wie es auf Deutsch auch genannt wird. So this technology was pretty important. It enabled a fast defense, so airplanes could have been detected on the radar before visual contact. This is a technology of acceleration, so to say, that the defense becomes faster. You see attacking airplanes more early. This technology has been developed and famously and successfully applied during World War II. Another example is this, the rockets. This is the Aggregat 4, it's a German word, famously known as V2, Vergeltungswaffe 2. You know, in Nazi Germany, they had the very strong and metaphoric names for everything, and this was so far for the propaganda, not only the Aggregat 4, but the Vergeltungswaffe 2. Peenemünde, this is a place on Usedom. Usedom is an island in the north of Germany, in the Eastern Sea. And there have been several facilities for creating those rockets. And those rockets also had been applied during World War II. Well, one more example, the deciphering of Enigma. So Enigma was the code, so to say, and the code machine of the German communication system. And this has been deciphered by English scientists. And those guys used technologies of cryptanalysis and created thereby early technological steps for computers, for later computers. This Alan Turing, a very important guy, who played a very important role here, a mathematical cryptological genius, so to say. But his personal history was very poor and very sad because he was gay, and this was really not what the British Empire wanted to have. So he committed suicide after World War II, I think in 1950s. A very sad story. So he was really one of the heroes of this situation, a brilliant scientist, but because of his sexual orientation, his end was pretty sad after the World War. Okay, and one last example, maybe one of the most famous examples, I don't know, the so-called Manhattan Project, realized by the USA, the development of nukes, nuclear bombs. This is one of the most earliest pictures of an explosion of a nuclear. A test explosion in a desert in the USA. One of the most earliest pictures. Here you see the typical mushroom. Can you see it?
Okay.
Well, many, many more examples could be added. For example, medicine. Antibiotics have been discovered during World War II, for example, by US American physicians. And so on and so on and so on. All in all, wars are boosters of technological developments. This is something which seems to be pretty true, but it's an ambivalent thing. I'm going to emphasize this point later. I chose those technologies because those technologies led to consequences that are very strong even today. So if you combine, for example, the nuclear bomb with the rockets, then you come to the intercontinental ballistic missiles, as we have them today. Radar, extremely important for civil and military aircrafts, airplanes, today, of course, extremely important development. If you combine it, you come to the technology of satellites later on. Without rockets, you cannot bring satellites in the sky. Without satellites, no GPS. Without computers, no abilities to use the information. Informationsverarbeitung, as we call it in Germany or in German language. Wars are boosters for technological developments even today. So, if you put this all together, rockets, aeronautics, satellites, GPS, computers, we end up here. MQ-9 Reaper drone. The Reaper is one of the drones which is applied today in US-American drone war, one of Obama's wars. So this technology is associated with him or linked to him. Maybe the next president will be the president of social media warfare, I'm not sure. Let's have a look what happens. Hopefully no war at all, but I have my doubts. And here you can see something which is pretty typical for technological developments as well, what we call developmental paths. Entwicklungspfade, that's a German word. Entwicklungspfad, English word is developmental path. So a technology, even a war technology like a drone, is not creatio ex nihilo. It's not coming from nowhere. There were ancestors, so to say. There were foreforms, technical foreforms. That's why I mentioned, for example, the radar, the early computers, and the rockets. If you put this together, you end up here. You end up also, of course, with space rockets. You maybe know the history of Werner von Braun, one of the chief organizers of the Nazi rocket program in Peenemünde and later on in Harz. Harz is the mountain in the middle of Germany. And after British bomber pilots started bombing Peenemünde, they brought the rockets there. So they expected to be more safe. And Werner von Braun and his guys have been captured by the US American forces after World War II, brought to the USA, and those guys have been part of the Moon Rocket project. So they started as military researchers in Germany, Nazi Germany, and then they played a major role in the Apollo program. Just for you to know as a little side history. So here we come to a point, I'm going to emphasize this later, where we see that it's sometimes really hard to distinguish between civil and military developments. Often this goes hand in hand. Okay, the other thing today is cyber war, cyber warfare, where we can explicitly mention the computers, a really new dimension. So war with codes, with hacking, and so on. So the smartphone, and even the notebooks. This looks pretty civil. A Wikipedia article on a smartphone or on a notebook. But the strange thing is, or the question is, what happens in the background, in the information structure, in the information infrastructure, and the networks. Today we have the global networks. It's pretty simple to have cyber war all over the world in real time today. a very strange situation. We can discuss this and emphasize this a little bit later if you like. So we can critically scrutinize those points, also from an ethical point of view, and I definitely want to highlight in this context this. The cute, lovely social robots, as they are going to enter our civil life. Maybe not today, but maybe tomorrow. There were, yeah, like Chibu, Sotar, Pepper and others. And those applications are civil, or at least appear civil. But in the background, the IT infrastructure is of course also present, and you can hack those systems, for example. That's the one point. Can you imagine what happens if you hack a social robot? Just, yeah, it's a toy maybe in the child's room of a children. Or it's a care robot in a hospital or on elderly care houses. Yeah, you create a Trojan horse 4.0, so to say. You have the critical infrastructure and you could easily hack it from the outside, in real time, all over into society. Yes, it's a little bit dangerous. And it illustrates the ambivalences of technological developments and technologies. Is the one point. The other point is, of course, which is ethically also a little bit problematic, that most funding sources for robotics research coming from military sources. Military budgets play a major role. And even if those tools appear civil on the surface, so to say, the technology behind has been also developed by military budgets. So ethically, it is a tricky field. You cannot really separate between civil research and military research. And here we come to the point. Wars are boosters for technological developments, exactly, and vice versa. Technological developments are also boosters for wars. That's the point I wanted to mention. Dual use, abuse, and multi-stability. The classical word here is dual use. The German word is Umnutzung. You have a technical tool, and the designer or the engineer has a certain intention. It is intended to fulfill a certain functionality. It's a mean for a concrete end, a concrete goal, a concrete target. Dual use means that you turn it around. So you have a civil application and then you use it for military purposes, for example. Here, horse, maybe. You have horses for agriculture and then it's warfare. So you use them for cavalry, for example. Abuse is a synonym for that, often sometimes used in the literature, dual use or abuse. Imagine, for example, what happens with the social robots. They are intended to function in a social environment. The engineers, the designers, create a social process. The functionality is a social process, an interaction. Those robots should interact with you. But those interactions could be abused. That means maybe ISIS, so-called Islamic State, hack it, maybe, and inject propaganda messages immediately in your house, in your home, in your child's room, wherever. Ouch. Dangerous. But it's a not so much science fiction-like scenario. You know that they hacked, for example, the web page and the social media accounts of... I'm not able to pronounce it in French, but the French sender, TV5, on the TV... Who's able to... Excellent. This happened, I think, in 2015, and they hacked the infrastructure of the sender, also the social media accounts. And this could be done with those tools as well. There's another term for that, multi-stability. Multi-stability means that technologies are not stable in their application. The watch is not stable in its application. It can misuse it. It is not only a watch, it's also a normative dimension. It standardizes my time, the rhythm of my day, and so on and so on. It is more than only mechanics. A knife is another very famous example. You can use it for breakfast, or to kill somebody, or for hunting, for arts, and so on. Many purposes. With horses, it's the same. Cavalry, war, breeding, agriculture, status symbols, sports. There are many things that could be performed with horses, for example. And the term is multi-stability. I'm pretty sure you often heard this term in this lecture series, so I do not need to emphasize it too much. And here we come to a crucial point. There are those categories, military, civil, which are often associated with words like combatant and non-combatant. That's a classical understanding. Also in law and politics. There's a combatant status and a non-combatant status. It becomes a little bit tricky with robots. Like this. Is this a combatant? Is this a non-combatant? You maybe know a little bit about the debates of roboethics, robotics, the meaning of autonomy, and the reflections on autonomy. Sometimes people call those tools autonomous weapons. Maybe in the future they will be able to perform autonomous killing decisions. Would we label this a combatant? Or is it still a tool? If it's still a tool, who's responsible for collateral damage, for example, if the tool autonomously decides who to kill and who not to kill? Strange questions for the ethics on the one hand, but also for the politics and for the law, of course. So those classical categories really become problematic. Where's the borderline between competent and non-competent? Yeah? So there are technological developments that really force us to rethink those categories. And there are social and political developments as well. I'm going to scrutinize this later. Exactly, here we have the point. The robots, and what for us is important, the robot ethics, responsibility, who is responsible for collateral damage, the question of agency and or autonomy. Is this an agent? Is this a soldier? Is this a comrade? Maybe you remember the lecture last week by Nolan Goertz, who presented the point that some soldiers run to rescue their destroyed robot because they treated it like a comrade, like a lived human comrade. Very interesting situation. And maybe you remember a little bit the discussion we had later on. I asked him the question about the sword, because ancient soldiers also give name to their swords, personalize it, animate it. So there are those challenges. I'm going to raise more questions than giving answers, so maybe we will have a little bit discussion. Or if you have a question, you can always go like this. And when we enter this field of conceptual clarifications, including combatant, non-combatant, civil life, military life, dual use, multi-stability, abuse, and so on and so on. Of course, here we need to add another pretty problematic term, the word war. What is war? So I presented some examples of technological developments, but I didn't clarify what war means yet. And this is not simple. I could say, unfortunately not simple, but maybe also luckily not simple. So there's a lot to do for philosophers, which is pretty good. This creates jobs. Okay. What I want to introduce now are two terms, two concepts, which are discussed today. The one concept is called old wars, and the other concept is called or discussed as new wars. Typical dialectical twist. Something is new, okay, here's the new thing. So, we need something which is old, as a contrast. No new world without an old world. Marie Kaldor is some famous author here. She wrote a book about new wars and old wars, analyzing the Yugoslavian wars in 1990, and she wanted to understand what happened there. Herfried Münkler is another example, another author who emphasized those relations between so-called old wars and new wars. Other authors as well, Irina Etzersdorfer, for example, she's working here in Vienna, and many more authors could be added who participate in this discourse. Mostly political scientists, not also sometimes philosophers, but most guys are political scientists or sociologists. Well, now what is the difference? To make it as simple as possible. This is a picture of a Napoleonic War, the Battle of Waterloo, 1815. And this is one symbol, one ideal of what is called Old War. Here you see combatants with national emblems that follow rules of warfare. So, you see those guys wearing their uniforms. And there isn't so far, even if it's chaotic on the battleground, but there is an order. You know who belongs to your side, and you know who's the enemy. There's a declaration of war, and then you have a battle. At the end, you have a winner and a loser, and this causes political consequences. This is the ideal, so to say, of an old war. National state fighting against national state, and the Napoleonic Wars are an example for that. So, national state is the monopolist of the war. This is what argued in those debates. So I follow what those guys say. It's not my own thesis. The national state is the monopolist of the war. There are no private actors. If there is war, then with usual combatants, with soldiers, which are educated by the government, so to say, paid and drilled. Drill is very important. You have a declaration of war. That means we have a concrete starting point and a concrete end. And this is the basis of international law of war. Völkerrecht, or Kriegsvölkerrecht, how we call it in Germany. Genfer Konvention and Hager Landkriegsordnung are examples also for that. How to legally treat and regulate war, warfare, and to define what is a crime of law, what are you allowed to do as combatant and what you are not allowed to do. But this is only possible if we have a strong distinction between combatant and non-combatant. If this distinction becomes blurry, then you get a lot of legal problems with international law of war. And this is what happens within the so-called new wars. So, the authors I mentioned, like Marie Kaldor, Herfried Münkle, Irene Etzersdorf, and many others, analyzed wars since 1991, so after the collapse of Soviet Union. And there have been a lot of conflicts. This is one example, Somalia, the civil war in Somalia. And the things that happened in Mogadishu, October 3 and 4, 1993. What happened there became famously known as Black Hawk Down. There are movies about that, there are video games. You could, if you're interested in that, you could also try to play it on the computer. A similar situation. Black Hawk is a helicopter like this. It's a helicopter like this. And there have been US forces in Somalia, and they tried to arrest Mohammed Farah Aidid, a warlord. So to say, a non-combatant. He was a warlord, he had a gang, so to say, in a pretty chaotic civil war-like situation. And with a UN mandate, the UA's forces, task forces, tried to intervene, so to say. It ended up in a little catastrophe, so Somalia units shot down two of those helicopters. All in all, it caused a battle for 2 days. Of course, then the US forces tried to rescue the surviving forces, their soldiers, their comrades. 18 US soldiers died, more than 70 have been injured. There were several numbers, up to 1,000 Somalian people have been killed in this situation. I mentioned it because here the situation is unclear. You didn't have the Somalian state fighting against the USA. This was a civil war-like situation with a lot of groups, with very diverse of very spreaded interests, and motives. A little bit similar to the situation in Syria right now. You have the so-called Islamic State, you have the Assad regime, and you have a lot of other parties. A lot of groups of opposition, and so on and so on. And this concrete date, or this concrete story of a new war, became pretty important. 18 US soldiers have been killed, and here you could see the power of media. the dead bodies have been on strings, carried through the streets, dead bodies. And people go, yeah, because you are soldiers. And there were photos about them, pretty cool photos. And those photos, those pictures went around all the world. And now happens, or the reaction or something, which seems to be pretty typical for conflicts like this. Maybe 1,000, even more people of Somalia had been killed. But the reaction, the emotional reaction in Western democracies was not so strong. What really was strong was to see the dead bodies of the American soldiers. And then the politicians in the USA need to find reasons for that. Why did we do this? Why did we sacrifice, so to say, our soldiers, our children, even if it had been only, so to say, put it into brackets, only 80. And this means that in Western societies, every victim counts, and you have a strong public pressure on every politician if you have at least one human victim. And this is maybe one reason why Obama pushed so much the drone wars. If you shoot a drone down, you don't have the pictures of the dead bodies. Okay, you lose a drone, it's important, it's expensive, but you do not lose your own soldiers, your own combatants. That's why I chose this example. It's an example of one of these new wars, and it had a strong impact on the political treatment of wars in the future. It's one political social motivation for the drone wars, for example. And maybe one reason why Obama hesitated to bring troops, infantry, to Syria, for example. Though in Iraq, of course, the US had the problem. I'm going to tell a little bit more about this. So, what happens here? On the one hand, you have the private sector, child soldiers, terrorists, mercenaries, also Söldner, warlords. Private people fighting, buying on the black market cheap guns, and then doing their war. Motives are economic, ethnic, or religious. They were more motives. Yeah? You fight because you earn money with that. You fight because of ethnic reasons. But there is no declaration of war as such. Yeah? You're not member of a concrete state or of a concrete regular army. So the situation and the political and social embedding of those conflicts is totally different. And these are two terms that are used in the discussion to illustrate what happens here. Symmetry versus asymmetry. Let me come back to the picture. This is asymmetry. You have one party with a helicopter, with a high-tech army, with drilled and highly educated soldiers with good technologies fighting against people on the ground with very simple weapons in a very, very, very chaotic situation. This asymmetry. Symmetry would be the Napoleon-like situation, as I try to illustrate with the picture. Technologically nearly the same level, and then army, regular army against regular army. This is called symmetry. Well, as often in the philosophy, those terms are pretty controversial. Some authors say, well, symmetry, it's just a construction. It never really happened. But at least it's one try to explain what happens here. The relation between symmetry and asymmetry. So we have the political symmetry and asymmetry. Yeah, political asymmetry means you have a national state fighting against maybe warlords. Or irregular troops, child soldiers, whatever. Or terrorists. There's economic symmetry and asymmetry, of course. Economy means power, means money. And the technological and scientific symmetry and asymmetry. And for us, of course, in this lecture, the last aspect is pretty important, even if we cannot totally separate it. Economy and politics always play a role in technological developments, but we primarily want to focus the technological issues of asymmetry. So, example, very famous 9/11, terrorist attacks. If this would be a symmetric war, Osama bin Laden would have used tanks and tried to conquer US territory. Of course, impossible. no technological chance. So, an asymmetric tactic. Grasping the infrastructure, so that means in this case airplanes, four airplanes all in all, and then use it to attack civil life, non-combatants. Okay, they also tried to destroy the Pentagon, but the Twin Towers have been a very important target here as well. And the third aspect is what you see here. What I present here is war, the picture, the war of pictures. It is part of terrorist strategies to create those shocking pictures. That's why public media sometimes hesitates to show pictures, to show IS videos, for example, because they always spread propaganda messages. Pictures and media technologies are part of those asymmetric warfares. You have it with Al-Qaeda and you have it with the so-called Islamic State today. Picture is a weapon because it causes psychological damage, fear, destabilizing societies. Well, they are not successful with that, but they at least try to do so. That's their weapon. And therefore they use technological infrastructures, internet, television, and so on and so on. Another example is the partisan tactic of asymmetric warfare. Here you see Soviet partisans with their simple weapons. They don't wear uniforms. Very few persons, but they try to attack infrastructure. There is no clear front line. They try to tease, to beat the enemy on its back, so to say. This asymmetry. In a real battle situation, those guys have no chance. The enemy would come with airplanes, with tanks, no chance for those guys. So they need to fight an asymmetric tactic. Partisan and guerrilla are typical examples for that. If you're interested in that, you could also focus, for example, the works and the theories and the histories of Che Guevara or Mao Zedong. These are other important and famous approaches of partisan and guerrilla tactics and 20th century theory of wars. And one aspect here is that you have a technical asymmetry. One party has a lot of technology, a lot of economy, a lot of power, and the other party not, but need to find ways to substitute it, so to say. Okay. What I wanted to introduce now is another conceptual issue here, acceleration and deceleration. So acceleration means you speed something up, and deceleration means you slow something down. And this plays a very important role in warfare. If you have the technical power to force your enemy to follow your rhythm, to follow your acceleration and deceleration, then you are the winner. It is a fight also about rhythm and about time. The party with the power about time wins. And this power is often technologically embedded. One of the famous examples is the Blitzkrieg. Again, World War II, German troops. Applied in East Europe, but also in West Europe. It's one picture. You see the tanks and the mechanized units. They are fast. They are mobile. Yeah. And the strategy is not to slow it down, easy going. Maybe we attack here, maybe we attack there. No. Fast, fast, fast. Time ensures success. And in order to accelerate the process, you need technologies. Yeah? Simple example is cavalry, for example. But there are many more technologies. Like infrastructure. Roman Empire did it by building the streets, for example. Napoleon did it with the chaussées, also streets. Hitler did it with the autobahn, with the highway. But also the railway is very important. 19th century. It caused a strong acceleration of warfare. In American Civil War, for example, or in World War I in Europe. And in World War II, of course, the tanks and the mechanized units. And a very important technology of acceleration is this, airplanes. Stukas, U-87 Sturzkampfbomber, it's a German word. So with the airplanes, you are, of course, faster. It's a tactic. You need a technology to be faster. Without technology, this is not possible, though there is a very close link between technological development and warfare. The opposite is deceleration, defensive. And this is often related to castles and fortresses. So here we have a siege, Belagerung. You slow the enemy down. He cannot walk. You have the fortress. No chance for the enemy. Okay, if he has airplanes, he can bomb. But as long as airplanes hadn't been developed, it was not possible. So this one example, Fort Boutange in Groningen, the Netherlands. I chose this picture because it really good illustrates the star structure of the fortress. This star structure of a fortress is a consequence of technological developments itself. It is, in Germany we call it Katz und Maus Spiel. Yeah, cat and mouse game. Somebody is in the offensive, the other one is in defensive. And you have the technological Wettrüsten, so to say. You improve your technologies to become better, better, better. And this structure of a fortress is the consequence of history, of centuries of improvement. Yeah? So this structure is typical for late fortresses in the 18th century. And this structure is physically forced because of artillery. When you have a castle like this, then you have a right angle. And physically, if you have an artillery, you have a right angle. You have a lot of power to destroy the wall. But if you have a star fortress like this, then it's a physical reason. And the other reason is a strategic one, because here at this point, you can situate your own defense artillery and attack the enemy even when he starts to come near. So you can see even in the buildings how technologically technological developments causes progress and process of adaptation. But the tactical logic behind is the same. If you're in the defensive, you try to slow the process down to make the enemy as slow as possible, so he's not able to get resources to conquer your level. Okay. Yeah, looks beautiful, but from a military point of view, not very efficient. But here again, you see the multi-stability of technology. This is, of course, also because of social reasons, a building of representation. Okay. What's that? Yes. Well, let me change the slides. Let me go to something which I presented October 10th. Oh, yes, looks good. Please, yes?
According to the exam next week, I'm not sure if you know that Kimberly tried to register. It wasn't possible.
I have no idea about the exams. I'm not able to give any answer. Caroline said a little bit at the beginning of this lecture today, but I don't say anything because she's the organizer and I don't want to give you wrong information.
Usually it's 2 weeks before the exam. If it doesn't work, I mean, then this is a problem and someone should drive to Caroline and ask. Because it should be already available.
Yeah, I'm not able to
try.
Yeah, but it doesn't pop up. I can't find it as an exam.
It's also a matter of acceleration and deceleration. Okay. So who participated? Exactly, contact Caroline. She knows everything and she can give you very precise and appropriate information. Who participated at the lecture at October 10th? Okay, at least two person. Three person. Four person. Maybe somebody don't remember. Okay. Well, these are some slides I presented in this presentation. I said If you want to do philosophy of technology, you should read between the lines. There is many more philosophy of technology than you actually think. The second thing I presented was understand the historical situation, real life and intellectual philosophical preconditions. The third thing, see consequences and applications in real life and further intellectual philosophical developments. Just to put it into brackets, this is a little bit what we did today, from Einstein to a nuclear bomb. And fourth, always be aware of several explicitly or implicitly mentioned meanings of techni episteme ars, so it means technology or technique, as artifact, skill or procedure. So there are several meanings of what technology technique actually means. Okay, I just wanted to repeat this, because what I wanted to do now is I want to present some quotations of well-known classical authors who wrote about war. Now we want to interpret it together, and I want you to follow me by reading between the lines and interpreting some of those pieces exactly in this motivation. Read between the lines, understand the historical situation, see consequences and applications, and always be aware of several meanings of what technology might be. Okay. Who of you is not able to read German? Okay. Well, who is 100% unable to read German? Who is 100% able to read German? Okay, so I guess we can find a compromise. Okay, so let us start. Acceleration. Okay, here we are. Reading between the lines. Well, let's start with this guy. Heraclit, a pre-Socratic philosopher, 500 before Christ, something like that. And he wrote some very famous phrases about war and warfare. Okay, I read it in German and then we discuss this in English, okay? Krieg ist von allem der Vater, von allem der König, denn die einen hat zu Göttern, die anderen zu Menschen, die einen zu Sklaven, die anderen zu Freien gemacht. So one of the very famous passages. Krieg ist von allem der Vater. War is the father of everything, so to say. And another passage, es gehört sich, dass man weiß, dass der Krieg etwas Allgemeines ist und recht Zwiespalt und dass alles geschieht in Übereinstimmung mit Zwiespalt und so auch verwendet wird. Another fragment. Yeah, you know, those pre-Socratic philosophers maybe wrote books, but if yes, we don't have these books today. Most things we only know because of fragments that have been used by other authors. So we can reconstruct what they thought. And the ancient Greek word for Krieg is polemos. Heraclit used it as a bit more as a cosmic metaphor. So when he wrote about war, he didn't think about Blitzkrieg. Of course, it was technologically not possible at his time. He maybe thought about phalanx. So more bodily technologies of performing warfare. And he came up with this very famous formula that war, that the fight, to put it into Darwinistic words, the struggle for life, so to say, is the father of everything. It is a cosmic metaphor, a cosmic order, so it's not only the war of human beings, it is a symbol of a dialectical order, so Übereinstimmung mit Zwiespalt. So there's a unity of differentiated things that struggle and fight and are in tension. It's a dialectic metaphor. And this is one interpretation of what war means. It has been also interpreted sometimes mythologically, of course, and in context of sports, Olympic Games. It's, yeah, you fight, but not in order to kill somebody, but but in order to be better. So there is the Olympic unity while having the split. The split is you and your partner, and who runs faster, so to say. So there have been the several interpretations and levels of that. So war here could mean sports, mythology, a cosmic order, political order, and a dialectical principle. I want to present some passages of Aristotle, no? Because Aristotle is the philosopher. Yeah? If somebody talked about the philosopher in ancient time or even in medieval times, it was Aristotle. So I chose this guy, and he wrote a book about politics, and here he wanted to find the perfect and justice Verfassung, confession. Verfassung of English?
Constitution.
Constitution, thank you. Exactly. He wanted to find the principles of a justice constitution and where people could have a good life. And thereby he also thought about war. For him, war was something like Erwerbskunst. This is now terminologically pretty interesting, because here he associated Polemos, Krieg, with Kriegskunst, with Technik, Kunstfertigkeit, a skill, like Jagdkunst, like hunting skills, like the art of hunting. So for him, war is like an art, a skill, a competence. It is not so much a technical tool, it's something you learn to do with your body. Like a handcraft master, so to say. Politically, this is pretty strange, because he argues that you hunt human beings in order to make them becoming your slaves. Well, from our point of view today, this is totally forbidden. No slavery anymore. But in ancient time, this was everyday life, so to say. And he said, Krieg, war, is a skill, a technique of hunting humans in order to force them to be slaves. Ethically today, really strange, but terminologically it's interesting, because here he associates the polymers with technology. This is another example for that. Here he talks about Sparta and Kreta. Die anderen behaupten dagegen, dass allein die despotische und tyrannische Form der Verfassung Glück als Glück gelten könne. So ist in Sparta und Kreta so ziemlich alle Erziehung und ein Großteil der Gesetze auf Krieger ausgerichtet. It's really interesting. So he tries to find the perfect constitution, Verfassung, which could create good luck, good life, and he discusses several forms of government and associates it with several ethnic groups, or alternate societies, so to say, and their style of performing war. So here you see the link already between war and politics. It is not only the Kunstfertigkeit, not only the technique, it's also a political issue. This quotation, again, is pretty interesting, because here he links the meaning of walls, of town, walls, of fortresses, to the concrete political system. Mit den Befestigungsanlagen ist das gleiche System nicht für alle Verfassungen von Nutzen. So if you have a different constitution, then you need a different fortress or different walls. Yeah, because you maybe need to protect yourself from the outside, but maybe also from the inside. Very interesting point. So the strategy and the political correlation between building a technical fortress and the political and social order. This quotation is pretty important. Wenn man überleben soll, dann muss man den Schutz von Mauern auch als die beste Vorkehrung für Kriege ansehen. Das gilt besonders jetzt, nachdem man bei Geschützen und Kriegsmaschinen Erfindung von solcher Wirksamkeit bei Belagerungen gemacht hat. Last sentence. Das gilt besonders jetzt, nachdem man bei Geschützen und Kriegsmaschinen Erfindung von solcher Wirksamkeit bei Belagerungen gemacht hat. Ja? Yeah? Cat and mouse game. You're in a defense situation? And somebody tries to attack you with better artillery, with better offensive technologies, vice versa, you need to build better walls. There you have to struggle. Better defense technology, better offensive technology, better defense, better offensive, and so on. And this technological logic, so to say, has been revealed here by Aristotle in ancient Greek times, something like 300 before Christ. Denn wie die Angreifer nach Mitteln sinnen, durch die sie die Oberhand gewinnen können, so stehen den Verteidigern einige Erfindungen schon zur Verfügung. Anderes müssen sie sich noch suchen und erdenken. Exactly. Philosophy of technology par excellence. Ja? So you have some means for your defense, but others we need to discover. Do research, so to say. Have technical progress and process. If you read between the lines, you can find those links between philosophy of technology and warfare in Aristotle's book about politics. One of the most important books in the European history of political developments. Okay, just to give you this ideas, how to read between the lines. Okay, now we come to the very famous slogan of Clausewitz. But before we do so, I just want to mention there a lot of authors, like Cicero, like Augustine, like many more, who wrote about war, just war theory, which led later on to the international law of war. I skip here a lot of authors. If you're interested in this, you can read, well, you can collect more information from the political sciences. So now I jump from ancient times to the 19th century, to Clausewitz, who's a very important author, well-known. Just by the way, in order to provide some pictures for you, I can also Google Clausewitz, so you can have a picture to have a little bit refreshing of your mind. If not, I can go on. I can go on. What do you prefer?
You can go on.
Okay, go on.
It's for me.
Okay. Well, anyway, I see you have some notebooks there. You can Google this guy yourself if you'd like to see a picture or know a little bit more about his life. This is one of the most famous sentences. Der Krieg ist eine bloße Fortsetzung der Politik mit anderen Mitteln. Der Krieg ist eine bloße Fortsetzung der Politik mit anderen Mitteln. So, war is the continuation of politics, but with different means. Well, I hope my translation was a little bit okay. Yeah. And this slogan is very famous. And this is the slogan, so to say, of the theory of the old war that I presented some minutes ago. Old war is Clausewitz-like war. You have national states having political interests and political tensions, and when you are at a certain point, you say, okay, now I need a new mean in order to reach my aim. And this new mean now is war. Well, we cannot talk to each other, okay, let's declare the war. Make it a little bit metaphorical, or to say a little bit more picture. And he writes, so sehen wir also, dass der Krieg nicht bloß ein politischer Akt, sondern ein wahres politisches Instrument ist, an instrument of politik, eine Fortsetzung des politischen Verkehrs, eine Durchführung desselben mit anderen Mitteln, so this is another formulation, but means the same as this. Was dem Kriege nun noch eigentümlich bleibt, bezieht sich nur auf die eigentümliche Natur seiner Mittel. So, war is a mean for political reasons, but includes its own means. So, soldiers, guns, artillery, horses, cavalry and so on. Die politische Absicht ist der Zweck, der Krieg ist das Mittel. Niemals kann das Mittel ohne Zweck gedacht werden. This is the typical means and relation. Okay. And here he comes to the conclusion. Der Krieg ist also ein Akt der Gewalt, um den Gegner zur Erfüllung unseres Willens zu zwingen. So it's an act of violence in order to force the enemy to fulfill or to follow our intention. That's what he writes. Die Gewalt rüstet sich mit den Erfindungen der Künste. So the violence or the violent act is equipped. Yeah, with art, that means technique, technical tools, technical developments, und Wissenschaften, and sciences, in order to perform violence, so to say. Yeah? So this is the inherent logic of war, to be technical, to be a technical process, including sciences as well. So, for example, imagine, or try to rethink about the nuclear bomb I presented at the beginning of this presentation. Yeah? It's a scientific act. You have the scientific research, and then you're able to create a technical application, the nuclear bombs, for example. Okay. These are the very important Clausewitz, like slogans, and again, here we immediately find the link to technology. Even when Clausewitz writes about politics and links war to politics, he does not forget the technology. It's really important. War is not only a social act. And for us as philosophers of technologies, those passages are, of course, the core, the essence, so to say, because it tells us what to do. And we could simply quote Clausewitz. Already Clausewitz said, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Again, Clausewitz, and this refers to what I explained about acceleration and deceleration. Clausewitz writes, "Und es kann daher in der Strategie nicht die Absicht sein, die Zeit um ihrer selbst willen zu seinem Verbündeten zu machen, indem man die Kräfte nach und nach zur Anwendung bringt." What does it mean? It means to do not slow the war down. You find the climax. The German word is Entscheidungsschlacht. The battle. And when you have the battle, you have a certain point of time, and there you push all your means in, all your power, all your energy. You don't slow it down. This is the conceptual core of what is called old war. You have the battle. Like you've seen in the picture with the on the Napoleonian Wars, Waterloo. In contrast, the new wars slow it down. It's a long time battle, because warlords earn money with that. But it's a difference. Even partisans try to slow it down. They don't have the same technologies, they don't have the same power, the same technical power, so they're trying to compensate it. With esprit, with passion, of course, and with time. It's a contra, Clausewitz slogan. Okay. Alles in einem Akt und einem Moment zusammengedrängt. One act, one moment. And then you compromise it. All your technical power. Okay. You still alright? Okay. Some fun for you. This is Miyamoto Musashi, a Japanese author who wrote about samurai sword fight. And I chose some passages of his book in order to illustrate some more bodily understandings of technology and warfare, which are not rooted in European history, but in Asian history. So he writes, for example, alles hat seinen Rhythmus, aber besonders in der Kampfkunst wird der Rhythmus nicht erreicht ohne stetes Üben. So, Kampfkunst, martial arts, the art of war, that means samurai sword fight, and there you have a rhythm, chak, 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 yeah? And you have a bodily rhythm. This is now really interesting again. So when he talks about technology in this meaning, he does not mean a concrete tool, like a pointer, or whatever, or a tank. Or even a sword. It is more bodily thought. The technique is what comes out of your body. You need to practice again, and then you come better. This is a more bodily understanding of technology. Kampfkunst, the art of war, so to say. In allem gibt es Übertragbares, Müdigkeit zum Beispiel oder ein Gen kann ansteckend sein. Auch die Zeit, wie sie verfließt, wechselt von einem zum anderen. So also the time is part of the interaction, so to say. You handle time on the bodily level here when you fight. That's swords. And then you try to find the right rhythm and the pause of the enemy's punch. So, you know the technique the enemy uses, chuck, 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 whatever. And then you try to understand his rhythm. When does he make a pause? And then you counter. Then you're in. You are the master of time, so to say. But not with tanks, not with a whole army, with your body. It is a more intimate bodily understanding of technology, as it is characteristic again for music, for arts, for example, for handcraft technology, or Kriegstechnie, as it has been used by Aristotle, for example. And here again, do you remember the different meanings of technology, which I mentioned? Technology is an artifact, yeah? That's the object, it's a sword, it's a tank, that's maybe the horse also. The second is the technique, the competence, it's exactly this, how to use the sword, that's the second meaning of technology. And the third one I presented was the procedure, of course, the procedure of the battle, this is the Clausewitz, having a climax. The acceleration, then you have one point, you have the punch, and this is a procedure, procedural understanding of technology. One word, at least three meanings. Yeah, we say technology, there are three layers. Also when we talk about warfare. Okay, well, I think this are the last quotations, I'm nearly finished. Sun Tzu, the famous ancient Chinese author who wrote about war, I think something like 500 before Christ, or even more early. And here again he comes to the point. Schnelligkeit ist die wichtigste Eigenschaft eines Kriegers. Nutze sie, um den Feind zu überrumpeln. Nimm einen Weg, mit dem er nicht rechnet, und greife ihn an, wenn er nicht darauf gefasst ist. Ja? Schnelligkeit, speed, is one of the most important capacities. Be able to be more fast than the enemy. Pretty close to what Clausewitz argues. Das Ziel des Krieges ist der Sieg, nicht die lange Dauer. Target is victory, not a long continuation. Yeah? So, warlords today have interest in a long continuation because they earn money with that. They have ethnic motives. They want to totally destroy an ethnic group or whatever. But Sun Tzu, close to Clausewitz, argues no. Having a short situation, a short punch, concentrate your technology as your power at one point, and then you have a result. So, wars in this sense want to have a result. New wars, in the sense of warlords or whatever, don't want to have a result in this meaning. There is no strict end of the process. Several meanings of war, several meanings of technology and the relations. And what happens today? Cyber war and drone war in global real time. Think about time. When you fight with a sword, you have a bodily aspect of time. It's your body that cognitively limits time. If you have a lot of rehearsals, you can be faster. Yeah, sometimes we see people dancing and we believe, wow, it's so fast, how is it possible? Because they did a very, very hard job while practicing. And they are unable to enable new aspects of time in their body. They learn better skills. But there are cognitive limits. So, with Blitzkrieg and tanks and so on, and the railway, there are also accelerations. Processes become faster. And we end up here. Cyber war and drone war in global real time. Milliseconds. All over the world. Yeah? The classical bodily understanding means you keep distance, so you win time, you are more safe. But in cyber war, no. How can I keep distance? I can only try to throw my smartphone away. Maybe even turning it off is not a solution. Yeah? Entnetzung. Cut your link to the network. That's the only chance. But as soon as you are in the network, distance does not help. What helps is maybe a typewriter, that you write letters with a typewriter, not with a computer. Entnetzung. No network. Yeah? And here we reach the level of acceleration, which seems to be a new quality. Why? First point, physical distance does not mean distance at all. Second, here we come to very strong ethical problems. What happens here is so fast that legal or ethical regulation and evaluation is not possible. There is no time to think about what happens. You have the computer actions in real time. You have no chance to think about what is ethical, what is not ethical. With high-speed trading and financial technologies, there have been issues like this in civil life. You have the high-speed trading. Chuck, 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 chuck. It happened so fast. And within milliseconds, some societies lost billions of dollars and others won. And you have no chance for reaction algorithms that are more fast, much more fast. And the point here is not only that it is ethically problematic, that's the one point, yeah, but the other more important point is that it totally destroys ethics, because it destroys human time, the human time scale. Even if as a human being you are able to create an ethical value judgment within maybe 2 seconds in a concrete situation. Should I should not? Is this a war of crime or not? Might I cause collateral damage or not? You have maybe 1 or 2 seconds. If you're trained, maybe faster, because you don't want to be killed yourself, so you try to be faster, but at least you have some seconds. But this is milliseconds. No chance. So in cyber war, and of course with the drone wars, it's exactly the same. Drones are IT systems. Flying robots, flying computers, but always embedded into IT networks. As I said at the beginning of this lecture, rockets, satellites, GPS. Without these networks, this technological infrastructure is no drone war. Without those cruel pictures of Mogadishu, maybe no drone war. And what happens here are drone pictures in real time all over the world. In Ramstein, in Germany, is a US Air Force base, which plays a very important role in the US global network. Yeah? So they can bring, so to say, the pictures from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Yemen, via Ramstein into the USA within milliseconds. Ten thousands of kilometers in real time. And the drone operators sit at home as if they would play computer. And after 8 hours of working, they go home. Oh, I did my job. No, I go to my family. It's strange. And you can imagine the very, very strong and ethically very problematic psychological damage. On the one hand, for those guys who operate the systems, see the pictures, are safe themselves, but kill people. And on the other hand, you can imagine, of course, the very brutal psychological damage of the victims. You live in a village in Pakistan, wherever. You don't have technologies to shoot the drones down. Yeah, so those drones are not very safe. If you have rockets, you could easily shoot them down, though they are applied in areas where people don't have air defense. Asymmetry. You are weaker, and the enemy is technologically far, 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 far better than you. This is fatalism. It's so brutal. You hear the drones, you see the drones, and you don't know when the strike starts. Is it you? Is it your neighbor? And the drone operators work in a non-combatant situation. They don't kill soldiers because the guys, the victims, don't have the national emblems, of course. So ethically and legally, a very strange situation, which causes a lot of trouble and a lot of discussions and a lot of challenges for regulation, of course. And all this happens in real time. Pictures in real time. The drone is 10,000 miles away from the operator. But the strike happens pretty fast. Okay. These are some references. This is my last slide. The drone and the co. Haha, how funny. Okay. Thank you for your attention. And if you have any questions or comments, we can have maybe a further discussion now, if you like.
Yes? A question.
Please.
About the ethics of technology. Mm-hmm. What's your professional view? The civilian application of technologies, for mm-hmm. example, of drones. Mm-hmm. I know it's, for example, now very broadly applied in agriculture, mm-hmm. Which provides great effects on the agriculture and its effectiveness. So does it outweigh the negative side.
Mm. Yeah, because I showed the picture with the cow and the quadcopter, exactly. Though you have the link to the agriculture applications. Of course, there are a lot of positive applications, and this is one example for the hard ambivalence of technological development. With nuclear technologies, it's exactly the same. You have the nuclear bombs and you have the nuclear power plants. Outweigh. Does it outweigh? Well, I'm a little bit naive and a little bit idealistic. I think this is a matter of regulation. And in context of drones, not of national regulation, of international regulation. It's a matter of the UN. And then it might be outrated with concrete rules and concrete laws. But I know I'm a little bit idealistic. There are many examples where the UN was not able to fulfill its responsibility for regulation. So it is a hard point. Maybe it does not outrate the positive issues to maybe not outright the negative issues. Why? We are here on the step to a totally new level of technology, technological autonomy. And we do not only create drones, we do not only create single tools. We create very, very complex networks with real-time capacities. And here we include systems that are able to autonomously perform decisions. The danger is very high, and maybe that's the point. But the giving an analogy, I think the nuclear technology has the same problem. We have the nuclear power plants, yes, but we have the trash, Atommüll. Trash, it takes millions of years to store it, and we have a nuclear bomb. We are able to destroy the whole mankind. Whole planet. For me, it's very hard to find an argument how to outweigh this. And I fear with autonomous technologies that perform in real time, we will come to the same point. That we create technology that is so destructive in real time that we have no time for reaction, that we create a really strong danger of destroying and killing ourselves, our whole planet. And so far, I'm a little bit skeptical. Just a little bit.
Isn't it the quality not only of modern technologies but of the of any technologies? I think there was an example with a stick, you know, the caveman and stick. So you could do some primitive agriculture, but at the same time, he's gotten his or her hand a weapon. So I mean, it's just the inherent to technology. Being both
exactly
at the same time.
Yeah, it's a multi-stability. It's both at the same time. Depends from the user, and you can find a similar argument in Clausewitz's work. Clausewitz also argues that war has an innate logic of totalitarianism. It gets total in itself because when a war starts, you apply the most radical tools and means you have. It has an innate logic of making it more total. It's exactly the same point. So you can use computers in a totalitarian war-like logic and then maybe destroy yourself. And at the same time, you can have so many very good civil applications with computers. So far, I'm also optimistic. It's very ambivalent. And yeah, let's hope that some of the new politicians that play a major role in the political world today are not as stupid as they might appear. More questions? Okay, perfect. So, thank you for your attention. But you're still here, still wake up a little bit. So, well, success with your exams next week and enjoy your holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.